Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, last week we started to study the Madhupindika Sutta. This is Sutta number 18 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the discourse on the honey bowl. And this sutta opens when the Buddha is dwelling at Kapalabhattu, his native city, and he's sitting at the root of a tree. He's gone into the woods, sitting at the root of the tree, and then one of the Sakyan clan named Dandapani comes to him and somewhat abruptly, almost rudely, asks him what he teaches. Maywanti. Shifu yao shoshi isha. So the Dandapani asked the Buddha, what do you teach? What do you proclaim? And then the Buddha says, I assert and proclaim my teaching in such a way that one does not quarrel with anyone in the world, with its gods, its maras, its brahmas, in this generation or population, with its ascetics, brahmins, princes, and people. And in such a way that perceptions no more underlie that Brahman. By Brahman, the Buddha here means an arahant, and I think particularly he refers to himself. Perceptions no more underlie that Brahman who abides detached from sensual pleasures, without perplexity, free of worry, free from craving for any kind of being. And when he says this, then apparently Dandapani is bewildered, he doesn't understand it, and he just departs somewhat abruptly. Okay, then in the evening the Buddha gets up, returns to the monastery and reports on what has taken place. And then a certain monk asks the Buddha, in effect he asks him, how are we to understand your statement? And then the Buddha replies, it's a somewhat cryptic reply in paragraph 8. He says, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendency, the latent tendency to lust, the underlying tendency to aversion or hatred, the underlying tendency to views, the underlying tendency to doubt, the underlying tendency to conceit, the underlying tendency to desire for being, the underlying tendency to ignorance. This is the end of resorting to rods, weapons, quarrels, brawls, disputes, and so on. Okay, so last week I spent some time explaining the meaning of the statement just in its own terms. But now the sutta continues that after the Buddha makes the statement, then he immediately gets up from his seat, goes into his dwelling, and probably closes the door. And the monks apparently were perplexed by what the Buddha had said. For them, the statement did not mean the end of perplexity, but the beginning of perplexity. Okay, and so when the Buddha has left, then the monks discuss among themselves, and they say that now the Buddha has risen from his seat and gone into his dwelling after giving a summary the Pali word here is, it's a technical word, uddesa, which means a summary without explaining the meaning in detail. And so now they're wondering, how are we going to find out the detailed meaning of this? Who is going to interpret the statement for us? And then it occurred to them that one monk was living at the monastery at that time. His name is Mahakachana. And now Mahakachana is known, was appointed by the Buddha as the monk who is the foremost in the Sangha in elaborating on brief sayings of himself. The Buddha would appoint monks to different, well, he appointed monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, to different categories of being foremost or most eminent. And one of these categories is being most eminent in the ability to take a short statement of the Buddha and then explain it in detail. And the monk that the Buddha assigned to this category was Mahakachana. So the monks then thought, now Mahakachana is living amongst us, and he has been praised by the Buddha, praised by other venerable monks. He will be capable of expounding the detailed meaning. And so they decide to go to Mahakachana and ask him to explain the meaning. Okay, so they go to Mahakachana and they plead with him, they request him to please expound the meaning to us. Then what comes here is a kind of stock passage, which we get in a number of suttas. Whenever monks go to another monk and ask him to explain the detailed meaning of a short statement of the Buddha, always we get the same exact passage. First, Mahakachana says that this is as if a person needed heartwood, the solid core of a tree. And then this person comes across a great tree which possesses heartwood, but he doesn't go directly for the trunk, but instead he cuts off the branches and the leaves, taking them away, thinking that this is heartwood. And so Mahakachana, in a somewhat humble way, he says that you are in the presence of the Buddha. The Buddha made the statement to you directly to your face. But instead of asking the Buddha about the meaning, you let the Buddha slip away and go into his dwelling, and then you come to me. I'm just like the branches and the leaves on the tree. So you shouldn't really be asking me about the meaning of this. Instead, you should ask the Buddha the meaning. And as he tells it to you, that's the way you should understand it. Okay, the monks then reply to Mahakachana, and they say, what you have said is true. Indeed, we should have asked the Buddha about the meaning. But still, you have been praised by the Buddha as being the foremost in elaborating on brief sayings. So please, you should please explain it to us. Okay, so Mahakachana listens to the appeal of these monks, and then he says, okay, I will explain it. Listen closely to what I say. So first, Mahakachana repeats the whole statement of the Buddha. And now he's going to explain the meaning. And it seems to me that in his explanation, he's first focusing upon the phrase in the Buddha's statement, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person. So he takes this phrase, or this Pali expression, yato nidanam. The word yato nidanam is made up of yato, which means from which, and then nidana means something like source or cause. And so here it's translated as to the source. As to the source. And so it seems to me that in Mahakachana's explanation, he's going to explain the gradual process, the step-by-step process through which these perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person. As I explained last week, this compound is made up of pancha, which means, which we can understand to mean mental proliferation, mental elaboration, the way the mind builds up its thought constructions, its whole scheme of ideas, especially thought constructions and ideas which are rooted in craving, conceit, and wrong views. Then sanya sankha. Sanya means perceptions, and sankha I understand to mean concepts or notions. And so what this compound seems to be saying, what it seems to signify, are the perceptions and notions that have arisen as a result of this mental proliferation, this mental elaboration of the data of perception, particularly this distorting mental elaboration, these ways of interpreting experience that are grounded in craving, conceit, and wrong views. Okay, so Mahakachana here begins with an explanation of how perception occurs, or how cognition occurs. So he starts off dependent on the eye and forms. Eye consciousness arises. This is said very often in the suttas. We have here the internal sense base or sense faculty, the eye, and the object, the form. Then depending on these two, based upon these two, eye consciousness arises, cognizing, seeing the forms through the eye. Okay, the meeting of the three is contact. When eye consciousness encounters the forms through the eye, we say that a meeting of the three has taken place. Eye consciousness contacts the forms through the eye, and that meeting is called contact, or pasa. Then, with contact as condition, there is feeling. Okay, whenever one contacts a particular form with eye consciousness, then that seeing of the form will be accompanied by some feeling. Okay, then, so here we seem to have a sequence of events. First, there's the eye and forms. Then based on these, eye consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. Then from contact, there arises feeling. Next, there comes a change in the manner of expression. What one feels, that one perceives. Here, there's not so much a sequence, but rather two ways of relating to the object that are occurring simultaneously. At the same time, one is feeling the object. One is experiencing the object, either pleasant, painful, or neutral. And one is perceiving the object. When one perceives the object, that means that one is focusing on the object in some selective way, some way which will single out particular characteristics, particular properties of the object. Okay, what one perceives, that one thinks about. The word here is vitakkheti, which is related to the noun vitakka. Okay, so based on the perceptions, thoughts occur. One reflects on the object. One starts thinking about the object. Okay, then based on the thinking about the object, or what one thinks about, that one, here the text uses the verb papancheti, which we translate mentally proliferates. That is, one is now in the stage of thinking about the object. One could be still thinking about the object in quite realistic, objective, rational ways, but with the expression that one mentally proliferates. Now these distorting factors of craving, conceit, wrong views, and other defilements are infiltrating the process of consciousness. And so now one is starting to think about the object in distorted ways. And one is building up a whole scheme of unrealistic, distorting categories for thinking about the object. Okay, then we come to the next stage. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, then perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. Here Mahakachana returns to the Buddha's original statement about how perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person. And he states that on account of this act of mental proliferation, then various perceptions or ideas, we might say different ideas and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person, overwhelm a person with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. Use an illustration of this. Maybe I'll repeat the same example that I used last week. Okay, we have the woman who's walking past the shoe store. Okay, so first, the form of the shoes will impinge upon her eye, and eye consciousness will arise. And then her head will turn to the window the window of the store, and she sees the shoes. Maybe there's a pair of red high-heeled shoes, very fashionable. Okay, so first, happening very quickly, there is contact, which is the coming together of the eye consciousness with the form, the appearance of the shoes that takes place through the eye. Okay, with this contact as condition, there is feeling. In this case, since let's assume she likes these shoes, so there'll be a pleasant feeling. At the same time now, because the attention has now been directed towards the shoes, she will start examining the shoes, looking at the particular features of the shoes, the color, is the color attractive, fashionable enough? How about the shape of the shoes? The heel, is it too high, too low, just right? Okay, so now, then maybe there's a sign for sale, 1 week only. 20% off. So she catches sight of the for sale sign. So now she starts thinking about the shoes. Do I really need a new pair of shoes? Do I want shoes like that? Okay, this is thinking about the shoes. Now she'll start mentally proliferating the pair of shoes. If I get a pair of shoes like that, will people look at me and admire me? So she wants admiration. If I have a pair of shoes like this, will I be sexually attractive? Will that make me more attractive? If I have a pair of shoes like that, is there any danger that somebody else might ridicule me for going beyond my means and buying a pair of shoes like that? So maybe some fear of ridicule. If I buy shoes like this, will I be spending beyond my means and then get into difficulties later? If I buy these shoes and I come home, will my husband notice that I'm wearing them or not? So all of these, you could say, are mental proliferations building upon the thoughts about the pair of shoes. And now we could say that these are now mental proliferations are starting to build up, and as they build up, they gain so much force over her that maybe she pulls herself away from the shop window, walks away, but as she's walking down the street, she's still thinking about the shoes, the image is flashing over and over in the mind. First there comes the desire to go back, turn around. There's one voice is saying, turn around, turn around. You have to go back to that shop and get the shoes. Maybe that's the only pair like that that they have. Somebody else is going to come in and buy them up, and then you'll miss your golden opportunity. Then she turns around and starts walking back. And then worried, am I going to be spending beyond my means? Maybe this is the wrong kind of shoes. Maybe it's for sale because the shoe companies are about to release a new style of shoe, and this one is going to be going out of style. Then I'm going to be wearing them, and everybody will be ridiculing me for wearing shoes that are out of style. So now she's caught between this desire and fear. So these are, let's say, perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation which are besetting this person with regard, in this case, not the past, but the future and the present. Okay, to take the other example I used, we have maybe it's her own husband sitting at home watching the football game on a Sunday. So as he's watching, there is eye consciousness, contact of the eye consciousness with the forms on the television. As he's watching, there will be feelings coming when his team makes, the team that he's chairing, makes some progress. Then there's pleasant feeling when his team is suffers a loss or is thrown back. Then there's feeling of displeasure. Along with this feeling, he is perceiving the game. While he's perceiving it, he's thinking about it. What move is he going to make next? Are my players going to advance, or is the opposite team going to win? So he's thinking about it in this way. As he's thinking about it, then he's mentally proliferating. He's identifying with his team, the team he is rooting for. He's wanting my team to get forward, my team to make the goals, my team to win the game. Okay, and as he's proliferating, mentally proliferating, then these ideas and notions are coming to overwhelm him. One is this craving for his team to win. Maybe he's made bets with his friends as to which team is going to win, and so he has additional motivation as to win the bet. Then he's afraid if his team loses, then some of his friends who are rooting for the other team, when they meet again, they are going to ridicule him. Then he will be humiliated. So in this way, he becomes overwhelmed by perceptions and ideas and notions born of mental proliferation, which arise on account of forms cognizable through the eye. Okay, then Mahakachana goes on and he explains the same process with regard to hearing sounds through the ears, smelling scents with the nose, in regard to tasting flavors with the tongue, feeling tangible objects with the body, and cognizing purely mental objects with the mind. Okay, so basically the whole sequence is repeated for each one. Okay, now when we take the sequence that I've put on the board here, we could say that there are certain stages in the sequence. First, there's one stage, which is quite, you could say, this part of the normal process of sensory consciousness or of sense cognition. That is all of the steps that begin with consciousness and go from consciousness to contact to, I left one out, feeling, perception, and thinking. Even thinking is part of the normal objective process of cognition. It's not that Buddhism says that one shouldn't think about any objects. Of course, when one is doing meditation, then one has to bring thinking, especially when one is practicing samadhi meditation, one has to bring thinking to a stop just by focusing on one object. But in the normal day-to-day experience, it's quite normal and natural to be thinking about the things one encounters. The problem starts in the step from thinking to papancha. papancha is the thinking about the objects that takes place through the under the influence of ignorance or delusion. And it's specifically, it's the thinking which is guided or manipulated by craving, conceit, and wrong views. And as I explained last week, of the different concepts that arise out of papancha, the most harmful, the most dangerous, according to Buddhism, are the concepts of mine, I, and myself. And we have the three driving forces of papancha, and each one is specifically related to one of these deluded thoughts. These three here are the three papanchas. The three papanchas are the three driving forces of this mental proliferation. And what results from the mental proliferation, what is called papanchita, are these distorted or deluded notions of mine through craving. One wants to take possession of things and make them mine. Then through conceit, one gives rise to the idea of I am better, I am equal, I am worse. And then through this tendency to views, one fashions a view, this is myself. Okay, maybe at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions on what has been explained so far. No question? Okay, then maybe we'll continue. Okay, paragraph 17 is in a sense almost like a recapitulation of what has been said so far. Okay, when there is the eye, a form, and an eye consciousness, then it's possible to point out the manifestation of contact. In other words, the eye, form, and eye consciousness, together these three things are the condition for contact. Okay, when there is the manifestation of contact, it is possible to point out the manifestation of feeling. That is, contact is the condition for feeling. Okay, when there is the manifestation of feeling, it is possible to point out the manifestation of perception. It seems to me that feeling is not actually a condition for perception, that both feeling and, well, let's say that feeling is not a special condition for perception, but rather feeling and perception both arise from contact. But I think perception is mentioned here because perception is the special condition for thinking. So when there is the manifestation of perception, it is possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. In order for thinking of an object to take place, there has to be a perception of the object. Okay, when there is the manifestation of thinking, it is possible to point out the manifestation. Here it's very difficult to translate to Pali, and it sounds rather awkward in English. It is possible to point out the manifestation of besetment by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. The text skips over papancha, or proliferation is a separate item. It goes directly from thinking to this besetment or being attacked by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. Okay, then the same thing is stated for each of the other sense bases, from the ear through the mind. then paragraph 18 just states the same thing negatively from the converse way, that in the absence of the condition, then there's no arising of the dependent phenomena. Okay, then Mahakachana says, paragraph 19, he sort of sums up his explanation and he says, when the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, rose from his seat and went into the dwelling after giving this brief statement without explaining the detailed meaning, then he repeats the whole statement. I understand the detailed meaning of this summary to be thus. Let's just go back to that original statement of the Buddha and see if we could understand it through the lens of Mahakachana's explanation. Okay, as to the source through which perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation beset a person. Now that source, we can see from that explanation, is this whole process of cognition, beginning with consciousness, making the acquaintance of the object, leading through feeling, perception, thinking about the object, and then mentally proliferating the object. So if nothing is found there to delight in, to welcome and to hold to. So if in this process of cognition, one doesn't delight in it, and the commentary explains that the word delight here implies the activity of craving, that it's through craving that one delights in the object. By welcoming it, the commentary explains, this word implies the presence of conceit, that one becomes conceited based upon something in one's experience. And to hold to, the commentary interprets to mean the presence of a fixed view, that is, some view of self, taking something within this process of feeling, perception, thinking, something within that to be myself, my true self. So if there's no delighting, no welcoming, no holding to this, then that means the end to these seven underlying tendencies, the underlying tendencies to lust, hatred or aversion, views, doubt, conceit, craving for existence, and ignorance. Also, when there is no delight, delighting, welcoming, and holding to anything within this process of cognition, then there is no taking up of rods and weapons, no fighting, quarrels, and disputes. And so Mahakachana says, this is the way I understand the detailed meaning of that brief statement of the Buddha. But now Mahakachana says, at the end he says, if you wish, go to the Buddha and ask him the meaning of this. And as the Blessed One explains it to you, in that way, you should remember it. Okay, so then the other monks get up. They express their appreciation to Mahakachana. Then they get up and they go to the Buddha and they explain to the Buddha the way Mahakachana interpreted his statement for them. Then the Buddha replies to them in paragraph 21. He says, Mahakachana is wise, he has great wisdom. Then he confirms Mahakachana's explanation and says, if you had asked me the meaning of this, I would have explained it to you in the same way that Mahakachana has explained it. That is, such is the meaning of this, and so you should remember it. Okay, then when the Buddha spoke this, then the Venerable Ananda now speaks up. And he gives a simile which will provide the title for the discourse. Ananda says that it's just as if a man who has been very weak and hungry should find a honey bowl. This is the Madhupinda, or Madhupindika. This is a bowl that's made of honey mixed with, could be wheat flour or rice flour. And wherever he tastes it, whether he tastes it from this side, that side, from the outside, the inside, wherever he takes a bite out of it, he will find that it has a sweet flavor. And so Venerable Ananda says that if a competent monk examines with wisdom the meaning of this discourse, then he would find satisfaction from it. Then Ananda says, what is the name of this discourse? And then the Buddha replies to him. He says, Ananda, you can remember this discourse as the honey bowl discourse, Madhupindika Pariyaya. And that is how the discourse got its name. Okay, now I'll ask whether there's any questions. Yeah, George.
This question has elements of dependent origination.
Yeah, one can see that the factors of dependent origination in Mahakachana's explanation.
And also it seems to have the khandhas of perception.
Any other khandhas present? Yeah, first let's take what other khandhas will be obvious here in this sequence. Well, let's take consciousness. So far we have feeling, consciousness, and perception. Three. We have the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and outward form, sound, smell. Those are belong to the form aggregate. Generally, the two are not juxtaposed, but whatever occurs in dependent origination has to be occurring to the and within the five khandhas, since in experience, there's nothing in experience that's outside the five khandhas. But this particular discourse isn't using the pattern of the five khandhas, but rather it begins with a pattern which is similar to dependent origination. Though it's not actually the full series of dependent origination. Though actually one could actually see here, let us just see that one could see here something paralleling the usual formula of dependent origination. In fact, we have some formulations of dependent origination that begin with dependent upon the eye and form, there arises eye consciousness, dependent on the ear and sounds, there arises ear consciousness, and in that way, rather than beginning with ignorance, volitional formations, and so on. Okay, so we start with forms, with eye forms, consciousness. Okay, then the meeting of the three is contact. With that, we're in dependent origination. Then based on contact, there arises feeling. Okay, that's also in the usual formula of dependent origination. Okay, the usual formula of dependent origination doesn't mention anything about sanya, perception, or vitakka, thinking. But I think we can understand that these are mentioned here because papancha is something that arises based upon vitakka, on thinking. And thinking arises based on perception. So papancha is somewhat like thinking, similar to thinking, except whereas vitakka is, you could say, ethically neutral. It can be quite accurate. For example, a scientist thinking about the results of an experiment. But papancha is a particular type of thinking. It's the thinking which is veered off the right course into the ditches of distorted thinking, thinking which misrepresents the objects under the domination of craving, conceit, wrong views, and other defilements. So we could have here a parallel if we take dependent origination, the usual formula, going from feeling to craving, then craving to clinging, clinging to bhava. So we could think of maybe papancha here as being related to craving, and papancha sanya sankha roughly related to clinging. Yeah, I have to say I find that passage somewhat puzzling, which is why I didn't want to stop to deal with it at length, because it seems to be saying that the only way you can get rid of being assailed or beset by perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation is by going back and eliminating the I forms and I consciousness. Whereas the way one actually practices the Buddha's path is not by going back and eliminating I forms and I consciousness, but by developing especially sati and sampajanya, that's mindfulness and clear comprehension, or sati and panya, mindfulness and wisdom, at the point where, say, feelings, perceptions, and thoughts arise. So this is part of what we call the normal, natural process of cognition. And where it swerves off course is when we allow our feelings and perceptions, and especially our thoughts, to just come under the domination of craving, conceit, views, or greed, hatred, and ignorance. And so by using mindfulness, one is able to keep the mind focused in the present on whatever object is presenting itself. Use mindfulness to turn back upon what is taking place within the mind. And then one uses clear comprehension and panya to understand that these are just conditioned processes which arise and pass away, so they're impermanent. So then by developing the insight into the impermanence and conditionality of these events, then one doesn't crave for them, doesn't cling to them, doesn't build up one's power of distorted ideas and notions upon them. Yes, Victor?
The process then, Bond says, that applies to an abstract concept like patriotism or an objective thing. Wouldn't the same mental processes?
The same mental processes can also apply to any kind of abstract idea. That would come, it's not only outward sensory, objects of outward sensory perception, but we have, as the sixth base, we have dependent on the mind and mind objects. Mind objects would be any kind of ideas. So, I mean, patriotism is a particularly salient example. So people get feelings of emotion whipped up on the basis of patriotism, and that leads to discrimination of us and them. Well, guarding the senses is actually, guarding the senses doesn't quite eliminate the sense of I. Oh, wait, say what you just said.
When you guard the senses, you sort of cut off.
Yeah, guarding the senses is also part of the process of restraining the building up of mental proliferation. In fact, if one goes to the standard, if you look at the standard passage on the guarding of the senses, the Sutta 27, this is page 274, Sutta 27, paragraph number 15. On seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief, that's craving and dejection, might invade him. So he practices the way of its restraint, he guards the eye faculty, he undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. So in this passage, the key phrase here is that he does not grasp at its signs and its features. That is, we say that the signs and features are those particular qualities of the object that normally serve as the base or foundation for building up thoughts that are governed by greed and aversion, by craving and aversion. So when one guards the senses, then one does not grasp at those signs and features. And then, on the one hand, you could say greed or craving and aversion don't build up. On the other hand, you could say that one does not build up this superstructure of mental proliferation. But one guards the senses with mindfulness and clear comprehension. Any further questions? Peter?
Is the hunting ball sort of incidental, or do we try to read it in a deeper meaning as to metaphorical in any way?
No. The question is whether we should read any special meaning into the use of this word expression, honeyball. I think it's just, the purpose is just to suggest, as the Buddha explains, that just as the honeyball, or I think it's Ananda who explains this, just as the honeyball is sweet wherever one tastes it, so the discourse is sweet wherever one examines it. Okay, if there's no further questions. Yeah, I will be back here next Tuesday also. We could have another class next Tuesday, make up for some lost time. Next Tuesday, I'll take Sutta number 24. It's called the Discourse on the Relay of Chariots, Ratha Vinita Sutta. Okay, so let us end by sharing the merits. Share the merits with the Devas, the Buddhas, the Nagas, asking them to protect the true Dhamma, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata Chabhumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavatacha amehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabe deva anumodantu. Sabha sampati siddhya. Etavatacha amehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabe bhutanumodantu. sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.